Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lau. And I'm a little distracted right now because somebody's turned my Facebook newsfeed into a porn site. Somebody has posted pretty risque pictures, and one of my friends has commented on her picture, so therefore it shows up in my newsfeed.
I like how you're holding your phone up kind of towards the microphone.
As to show all the audience.
Oh, so I can see it.
So you're complaining about it, but you're still looking at it.
Well, it's quite a lot. That are kind of strange. It's like people just going crazy, like they've never seen a semi-nude picture before. Like, there's like, too hot. And, wow, you are beautiful. And something with her having balls, which kind of threw me. I wasn't sure if she was a transsexual or not.
We still don't know.
Yeah, not 100% sure. And then one guy is like, oh man, he just posts all the time. He's got heart, a lot of exclamation points. And then 12 days later, he goes, heart, so hot.
Sorry, 12?
12 days later.
12 days later.
12 days later.
Well, you know, you have to let that cool down period so you don't seem too desperate.
Yeah. Well, it's the 12-day rule, Wayne.
12-day Facebook rule.
Yeah. And then it's like, so hot. Right now I want you so much. And I'm like, this is Facebook. It's like, it's not one of those dating sites. And then three people liked that for some reason.
Well, they felt the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, she'll see that I like that comment, and then she'll...
Like me.
Yeah, like me. And then he kind of broke his 12-day rule, and 8 days later, he just posts a heart. Then 2 days later, posts a heart again. Just like, wow.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And then she tries to get all philosophical. There's like, not hot always, maybe naked always, LOL.
That was her?
Yeah. She says, yeah, my heart, always pure naked. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, you're not posting pictures of your heart unless I'm supposed to see through your hand and your breast.
I'm going to try, dang it.
Now, I learned a new word today. It's called a Facebook philosopher.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And it refers to someone who posts...
Wouldn't that be a new phrase?
All right, fine.
Could that be two words, actually?
Could be hyphenated.
I don't think you'd hyphenate that.
Please continue.
Anyway, it's just refers to someone who posts those kind of like little daily wisdom things like, just take life one step at a time. You know, or, I don't know, trying is the hardest thing. Kind of using a negative term. We all have people who post those cheesy messages.
Yeah, I get some friends that like that. One guy's really interesting, though. Right, it's like really out there.
Well, perhaps he's an actual philosopher.
Could be. Could be. Yeah. So, yeah, I guess that was kind of the...
Highlight of your day?
Well, or maybe waiting an hour on the train for the start. There was a jumper on my train. There was a jumper on some train that was on my train line, which delayed my train. It's not like somebody jumped off my train.
There's some guy standing next to me jumping the whole time.
Yeah. Don't jump! Other than that...
An exciting day.
It was really exciting, yeah.
Yes, it was.
So moving on to our next entry into the D&D Next diary. Dear D&D Next, today, all my Cosmo reading really paid off. Because I could tell this girl was really giving me signals on the train. It was all there. Pointing the feet towards me, the hair playing, the lip biting, the chest puffing and angling, the swaying into me. This really has nothing to do with D&D. I just wanted to say it.
And then she jumped.
That'd be monstrous. Whoa, and speaking of monstrous...
Hey!
You turn Greek all of a sudden?
Oh! So we thought we'd talk about the monsters. There was a couple new articles from Mike Merles, or newish articles from Mike Merles, about the monsters in the D&D Next playtest and kind of their origins, which unsurprisingly is the first four editions.
It was also kind of just, I guess, information about kind of what the stat block would look like. There was mention of about how much fluff they were going to put into each entry, and I guess kind of like mention of if... monsters would have powers, like in 4E.
So what'd you think about it, Chris?
Well, looking at it, I think you disagreed, Lyle, but I thought they looked kind of similar to 3.5, the monsters, in that they had a little bit more information about the monster, like ecology and things, but also it kind of broke down their powers into, was it special traits and I think special actions it was, which is kind of similar to their defenses and offenses that they had, like in 3.5. That's what it reminded me of, but I think you said it was more like kind of somewhere in the middle of 2 and 4. which would be 3, but...
I was agreeing with you once you did the math, dummy.
A little bit closer to 4, which makes it 3.5.
A lot of that was based on the articles. Mm-hmm. Mike Merles seemed to be making a real concerted effort to make specific mention where he was drawing from, how he was drawing from 2nd edition and 4th edition. Mm-hmm. And as you said, Chris, that's kind of, you could say that 3rd is a happy medium between those two. So I think there was a lot. I think Wayne said before the podcast, he was certainly doing a little bit of appeasing maybe. Or at least reassuring that if the things don't look like 4E right now, don't worry. A lot of the philosophy in 4E is here, such as like the experience points and how they're going to use that to help you plan your encounters. And then, of course, like showing the monstrous compendium from 2nd edition and saying, oh, this was kind of like our library and where we go, and looking at all the things that they wrote in 2nd edition about the ecology and that, which was quite a popular series in Dragon Magazine.
Yeah, I think it's a great choice, because one of the strongest features of 4E was the way that you could build encounters and creatures from the books. There was a really nice, there's a lot of math to it, but a nice flow that took the characters' levels and the number of PCs into account and building an encounter that would fit right for whatever you wanted. You can make it more easy and more difficult, because that was always a drawback in D&D, is it was hard to choose a monster and know whether it was a good match for the party or not.
Well, didn't, like, I never ran 4th edition, but didn't 3 and 3.5 have that challenge rating system, the CR system?
They did, but it wasn't really smooth. It was hard to calculate challenge rating on monsters, especially once you started moving, like fiddling with their stats for the group.
Right. Yeah, I know they kind of had some rules to kind of figure out, okay, you know, if there's like an extra member in the party, mm-hmm. then do this. And if it's a group of monsters, then they're worth that much. But since you ran 4th edition, like, you did the encounter, so how easy was it to build encounters in 4th edition?
Oh, very. Really, you just take the number of PCs and their level, and that gives you like a budget of experience that you can use to spend on monsters. And then the monsters have their own experience point values, and you just buy from that. That said, I wasn't very good at it. My encounters were often pretty unbalanced, but as far as the system goes, it's was laid out pretty well.
Well, in the article, they did say that they are going to do, they mentioned kind of that experience point budget that the DM has to build encounters from. So it sounds like they're going to have something similar to what they had in 4th edition.
Which is great.
Well, the only thing they have on in the playtest is they do have XP. Hmm. So the Medusa is 450 and the Orcs 125. Hmm. What we don't see here are things like challenge rating.
True, but as a playtest, you know, it could always be something that's in the works for later on.
But would you recommend it? Because...
No, compared to the 4E system? No, not at all.
Right. I mean, what they don't need to do is add more numbers.
Right.
Like, there's already, you know, you have your stat block or an ability block, so a new player could recognize that if they were going to try out game mastering for the first time or DMing. Mm-hmm. Because they'll see, like, the strength, dex, constitution. They'd already be familiar with that, already be familiar with hit points, already be familiar with armor class, so... And I think that's one thing that the monsters, I guess probably two schools of thought. If you make it like, sometimes when you try to make it very more abstract than, let's say, the player, or an abstraction of the player sheet, so somehow that's simpler. But sometimes that's not always the case.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know some other games, like World of Darkness, if they have like NPCs, they'll make a lot of them, again, simplifications, I suppose, but I can also then see somebody looking at the limited numbers that they provide for these people and then finding that more confusing just because it is different from the character sheet, the normal character sheet. Here's what they could do, not necessarily adding a lot of numbers, but maybe highlighting the numbers better, the ones that they would use most often. So if somebody then wants to use, let's say, the orc in non-combat situations, they do have a stat block in which to work from. But 95% of the time, they'll probably only use them in a melee or a ranged attack.
Well, it might be interesting to note that with D&D Next, there aren't skills anymore. So non-combat actions are all just based on stats, which it gives for the monsters anyway.
Right. So they provide that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But if they could, like right now, melee attack and ranged attack are just kind of listed down the column, mm-hmm. which is fine, but perhaps to highlight them a little bit more. And I know, of course, it is just a playtest and... Mike Merles was dropping hints that they were, or maybe they weren't even hints, but saying that maybe it's going to look a little bit more like 4E than it does currently, making more use of boxes and stuff like that. And that, you know, even just a box is like, this is kind of their core combat stats.
One of the other things he mentioned in the article was they're thinking about having like mob monsters like orc grunts or goblins, not giving the individuals any kind of special power or special ability, but instead, I guess, giving the powers or special abilities to kind of the leader. And I thought this was kind of weird. The way he words it, like a mob of gnolls would kind of attack randomly, but a mob of gnolls with kind of like a war priest or whatever kind of leader they have would attack a bit more. They'd use more tactics. And in the article, it seemed like he was implying that that would be because of the mechanics that the leader granted the mob. But I don't know. I was kind of wondering how much mechanics affects how monsters play, or whether that's more just how the DM plays them.
I think it has a lot to do with mechanics, because the leader specifically has different kinds of powers that kind of reflect how the monster is supposed to be played. For example, like the gnolls have, I believe it's a frenzied power. Let's see, I'm just checking now. Yeah, demonic frenzy, where they can they and their minions go on to basically like a berserker-style attack. The orcs have something similar, but it's based on a charge, and I think the hobgoblins have a more of a formation representing their more kind of military kind of feel. Goblins, I think, run away, but I'd have to double-check on that, but... Yeah, goblins have what's called cunning tactics.
I guess. I'm just wondering, like, could that be part of the fluff or the description? Or does it actually have to be, you know, like a power or a mechanic?
It could be. I mean, it is a power and a mechanic that's used, I guess, maybe to make them feel more like their type in combat. But, I mean, you've got a very good point that, you know, you can just play goblins like goblins are supposed to be played and be perfectly happy.
How would you know how they're supposed to be played?
Well, they, unlike 4E, they actually have descriptions of the monsters in this version.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of the, you know, the 3.5 stuff where it would have the little combat and tactics section.
Yeah, and they have that. They have combat and their habitat and society and everything like that. Legends and lore. It also looks from the listings here that, like, all the monsters have their special kinds of actions. Or, sorry, some of the monsters have special actions that they can use. Like, a Minotaur has a goring charge and things like that. There's also a few here that don't have descriptions. So I'm wondering if there's going to be, like, a whole library of base description or base actions that monsters can take. I think in here, it was Scuttle was an example that was on two or three monsters, but there's no description of what Scuttle means.
Oh, I mean, like, I think one of them... One of the things in the article was the possibility that this tactical combat module that they brought up will kind of have stunts or kind of like basic, not really feats, but kind of like special actions that a monster can take. So there'll be like kind of a library of generic special actions or that the GM can have the monster do in this sort of tactical module that might not be available if you don't use it.
I'm pretty certain that that's going to be part of a thing, because I've heard the tactical module be mentioned in other posts on the D&D website as well, so it seems like it's a pretty sure thing.
Yeah.
What do you think that's going to be?
Honestly, it kind of reminded me of the stunts mechanic from that Dragon Age RPG. Not exactly, but that's what it made me think of. You know, like, oh, this monster is big, or has like a strength value of 16, which gives me the option to use these special monster moves.
It could be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it could be a lot of fun.
Or could be complex. I mean, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Could be a lot of fun. Could be complex. Could slow combat down.
It could suck heavily.
Yeah.
All right, well, we'll end on that speculation, and we'll move on to the topic for today's episode, or the double topics. One is Apocalypse World, and the other is playing on Skype, which we did for the first time. So I'll turn it over to Wayne, and he'll talk about, or give you a little background on what Apocalypse World is.
Yeah, Apocalypse World was a game that I'd heard mentioned before on other various places, and I was really interested to try out. It's written by Vincent Baker, which is the same guy who wrote Dogs in the Vineyard and a couple other indie games, and I don't know, I guess the title kind of is very... I thought it was kind of evocative. It's Apocalypse World. It's a post-apocalyptic...
World?
Game. Yeah, world. Yeah, thank you. Like I said, not that hard to understand.
I thought it was fantasy. Jeez.
Evocative or literal?
Both. Both. So, after reading through the book, I don't know, I kind of decided that I wanted to try and run it.
Your descriptions always are you recounting, you know, the story of you and that... Just kind of hoping for a brief
like
description
what?
Of the game, you know. I think it was 2010 when I first heard of it.
All right.
It was raining outside.
I was peeking down the raining.
Okay, well, Apocalypse World seems to feature pretty simplistic mechanics. There's only one type of die roll that you can do for it. But it has only four stats, was it, Wayne?
Yeah, as you said, Chris, there's one die mechanic, very simple rules. There's only five stats. And I guess, to put it bluntly, the dice mechanic boils down to the player's either going to succeed with, succeed with benefits. They're going
Which
to
success.
Yeah, they're going to succeed, but at a cost, or they'll have to make a decision, or they're going to fail. And that the dice roll basically just sort of drives the fiction of the story.
Would you describe this as a narrative game?
I would.
Yeah, I would. Extremely narrative.
Well, I think it would help. Like, they have certain key concepts, and to go over, like, one of them is a thing called moves. And then even if you could explain, like, I mean, it's only five attributes, but even the names, I think, are very helpful.
So the five different stats then are cool, which allows you to do something under fire. Hard, which allows you to, quote, go aggro or seize by force. Hot, which allows you to seduce or manipulate. Sharp, which allows you to read a stitch or a person. And weird, which allows you to open your brain.
Yeah, actually, there's actual, a weird sixth stat, which is history, which represents how well you know the other characters, or how well your character knows the other characters. And it's not a common stat to use, but you can use it for certain moves. So there are essentially kind of six stats.
Yeah.
And as you said, Lyle, these things called moves are basically, they're described in the book by Vincent as sort of fictional triggers. So in other words, the character will do something in the fiction that triggers one of these moves, or the player will want to do one of these moves and therefore will have to do something in the fiction to trigger them.
So you wouldn't describe them as like stunts or feats, powers?
Maybe I would, because I guess it seems to be very much a game where you, well, like other role-playing games, you would kind of only roll when this action is important enough to kind of have a chance of failure. You know, so like ordinary kind of mundane things you wouldn't even necessarily roll for. So I guess I could see them as sort of powers or feats in a sense that way, where they're going to be interesting or special enough where you're going to want to see what happens as a result, or the outcome could be uncertain. Like when we were playing the game, like at one point in the game, Chris had his character and he said, "All right, I'm just going to haul off and punch the guy." And I said, "Okay," and you punch him. He's down on the ground. And I think, Chris, you were kind of surprised that you didn't have to make any kind of roll to do that.
I was.
I guess he's speechless.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
Yeah, because basically at that point, there was no point to roll, because I just said, well, this thing is going to happen. It's not kind of worth rolling over.
The character creation system is pretty different from a lot of other games, in that it's very collaborative, and there actually is a little bit of back and forth between the players as to what numbers they put down or what they highlight.
Yeah, so...
So what? Maybe if you walked us through the experience we had. So we had three players, and Wayne was our MC.
Yes.
MC Wayne.
And it might be helpful to know some of the characters that we were playing. I was playing a Hocus, and that is kind of like a cult leader.
Yeah.
And I opted to make it like a religious cult leader.
Man, what a great idea.
And then Chris was...
A faceless, which is, if you know the Humongous from Mad Max 2, was it?
Yeah, the Roadrunner.
Yeah. Yeah, basically he's a guy who always wears a mask, but he's also big and horrible, and he's like a murder hammer.
Yeah, not a murder hobo, a murder hammer.
And Yujiro was?
Yujiro was playing something called a touchstone. Mm-hmm. And that character has a symbol of hope for either a better future or things that were in the past and he was trying to recapture. Basically, he was not really a prophet, but basically the whole idea of that character was to kind of build a better future out of this ravaged apocalypse world.
With his gun?
Sorry, yeah. Like, the thing about character creation is, as you said, Lyle, it's very different. And rather than sort of poring through a book and choosing options, you are given what's called a little playbook that's only sort of for that character class. And there's a lot of lists you choose from, including name, look, your gear, your basic stat array. And like we said, for Yujiro's character, there was an option at the back for what his symbol represented, and he was allowed to choose what that object was, and he chose a gun, despite his kind of future thing being peace, which I thought was kind of weird.
I think he's just going for like the whole sheriff angle, peace through superior firepower or something like that.
Yeah, change must just come at the barrel of a gun.
Yeah. But as you said, Lyle, it is very collaborative mm-hmm. in this character process, because that sixth stat, that history, you kind of assign, how to explain it? There's a little, I guess, script inside each playbook, and it'll say something like, for example, like, someone is part of your cult, or someone had your back when you had a fight, or you don't trust someone, and then it'll give you a number to give to that person, either positive or negative. And positive represents you know that person better, and negative represents you don't know that person very well. So I think that's what you were saying when it's kind of collaborative, in that you kind of go around the table and say, okay, you know, for example, Chris, my character and your character, you had my back in a fight, so you're going to have history plus two.
Mm-hmm.
So, and after you do that, everybody should have kind of a numbers for all the other players or all the other player characters in the game. So I think the goal is to kind of encourage you to make a story or some kind of a little backstory between your characters right there at character creation.
Yeah, and I gotta say, like, this was, I think, the thing that impressed me most about this whole game system. I'd never built characters this way before, and it was really cool. It kind of built the party together at first, but it also created drama and triangles. I think, for example, my character's history was, you and one of the other characters have done something terrible. What was it? And then give them that amount of history. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, like, the goal is to kind of say, the way I see it, and the way I think it's presented, is these options and the things you pick are supposed to generate questions more so than answer them. Such as, yeah, as you said, Chris, what was this horrible thing that we did together? Well, you know, I and the other player should talk about it and come to something that we both agree with. And, you know, that's now what happened.
Yeah.
So, which is very different. And it was kind of actually hard to get a grasp on or convey how much, I guess, narrative power the players have in sort of defining the world.
Right. Now, since you're talking about defining the world, there didn't seem to be a lot of definition to the world, or it doesn't come with like a setting in and of itself. Is the idea, if I'm correct here, is that the player's choices create the world, right?
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
Right. I didn't think that worked out very well.
It didn't in our game, and I think I put a lot of that on me, because I don't think maybe I didn't convey that very well, but
I think Apocalypse, when you're talking about the Apocalypse, I think it's a lot broader than maybe people think, and people come at it with a different perspective of what an Apocalypse is. It's almost like saying fantasy world or science fiction world. And if people can imagine sitting down and a collaborative process, and somehow you're going to establish what the science fiction setting is just by asking each other some questions and establishing a connection with the people or the other players, then I think it's going to fail a little bit, because then as soon as the game starts, people still don't really know what the world is. They might know that these two players did something terrible together and have a dark secret, but I guess if the goal in Apocalypse World is that the players' choices and their character choices and the choices they make in the character creation process was going to help set up the world, like, I didn't see that. The closest thing that we did is when I had a question and it was like, what kind of cult is it? And I said something kind of like one of those traveling ministries, those tent ministries. So well, I guess like a caravan or even like a traveling circus. And I guess that kind of threw you because you had kind of set up you're going to be in this like abandoned mining complex.
Well, I guess it did throw me. And the way the book is written, it tells the MC very much to run a sandbox. The author very bluntly says, do not plan anything out. Do not come up with little scenes that you want to put the player characters into. Do not come up with little story hooks for them. And your caravan idea did throw me, Lyle, because not so much that I had this idea that I was going to send you to a certain place, just the idea that you're mobile, which now means kind of any danger that I do throw at you, you have the option of running away. Or any NPC I present that you kind of don't like, you have the option of just moving on. And I wasn't really sure how I was going to handle that.
We're a caravan of like 30 to 40 people. It's not like we can just like run away.
Well,
quick, pack up the stuff. All right, they're still coming.
I suppose,
can you pack it up in a minute? No, we can't. All right.
Just leave the stuff behind. Yeah,
I think that the whole caravan thing really did throw you for a loop. It was pretty obvious, actually. But, I mean, just because we built the world so quickly right there in front of you that you didn't really have time to consider all of the ins and outs of it. Like, we found out later on in the sessions that the limited number of people we had was making it difficult for you to have NPCs because we would know everyone inside our caravan. And also kind of led to where how much we had to get along with the other people that we were relying on to survive. So...
yeah, that was actually pretty funny. I tried to introduce a new NPC to kind of like throw a monkey wrench in Lyle's plant and all this. And he's like, wait a minute, where did she come from?
Why don't I know this person?
Yeah, there's only 100 people in this group. Do I know everybody? Oh, it was kind of different for me.
Yeah, but I mean, that's part of the game, though, is to play along with what you're given. So
I would recommend it. And we've also moved on to another game called Monster Hearts, which shares a similar system. And I think we kind of learned a little bit of a lesson there in that when we did the same... collaborative process, we actually started talking a lot more about what kind of setting. Very briefly, Monster Hearts is a supernatural teenage romance game. So think Jennifer's Body or Buffy the Vampire Slayer or Mean Girls, which we were doing some research prior to the episode.
Mean Girls with zombies or something.
Mean Zombie Girls, yeah.
Yeah. Heathers with werewolves. So already the scope is a bit narrower, so it was easier to grab onto. But we spent a lot of time talking about the world around us. Were we going to be in a boarding school or were we going to be in a regular high school?
Yeah, what kind of places were in the town that we teenagers hang out at? Yeah. All that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So I thought that was a lot more helpful and perhaps we should have done a lot more of that in Apocalypse World. What movies are you guys thinking of when you're sitting down at this table? If you were playing, again, I don't think there is a science fiction world. I'm using that as an example.
Yeah.
And somebody goes, Dune. All right, great. And somebody's coming at you with Star Trek. Hey, we have a little bit of a divide.
There might be a disconnect here.
Yeah.
And
Chris even changed one. He was going to play the Queen Bee.
Oh, just the Queen.
Oh, sorry, the Queen. Mean Girls, they had the Queen Bee.
Yeah.
The Queen... and it's a type of character, if you imagine like the most popular girl in school. But when we're talking about the setting and talking about our other players, then he decided to change who he was going to be based on that. So I thought that was very helpful, where I think in Apocalypse World, we kind of were already committed to what we were going to be. And then we kind of collaborated to establish these connections in a world we had no idea. I mean, are there mutants, not mutants?
Yeah, we were making decisions that we had no idea the consequences of.
Yeah,
and again, I kind of put that on this being the first time I tried to run Apocalypse World, because what's supposed to happen in the game, and this is also supposed to happen in Monster Hearts, although in a slightly different way, is after you set up your character and after you make these connections, the first session is supposed to be me, the MC, kind of finding out sort of what you do on a daily basis to set up scenes like, okay, great, your character wakes up in the morning, what's the first thing you do? Or, great, where do you get your food from? Or who goes with you to get that food? And what do you do? And I guess it's supposed to be...
I think it's the world, but that was actually kind of boring. We're in a game like Monster Hearts where it is kind of high school, and that can actually be kind of fun or funny, the routine. But if you're talking about a world you know, that's scorched, and it's like, oh, let's go see if we can dig up some cans, or let's see how the vegetable garden is going. It wasn't terribly stimulating, like establishing, you know, a drudgery, you know.
Mm. Well, it's not only supposed to be a drudgery, like...
And then I had to make the...
If we were a band of pirates, it probably would have been more exciting. What do you do in the morning? But, you know, we were tending a caravan, so...
Yeah.
I've kind of condensed that. That's not supposed to be, like, the end-all, be-all, right? Like, the book does have, like, a whole sort of list of things you're supposed to do for that first session. And some of them are, like, yeah, you know, have a fight, and because why not? The idea behind it and Monster Arts is kind of, yeah, to ask the player's input and to ask leading questions or kind of, you know, difficult questions to kind of set up, I guess, a baseline of what happens. That in the next session, I, the MC, or the MC, is supposed to kind of push that off kilter.
Mm-hmm.
Great, we've set up the fact that you do have a vegetable garden. And the next session, and you know what? There's fire coming from it. What are you going to do?
Put water on.
Put out the fire.
Okay, Mr. Literal. But I do agree with you, Lyle, that...
I'm not sure if a whole session on baselining is that great. I'm sure players can buy in and, like, okay, we understand what this is going to be. But, I mean... But you understand that in the movie, and you understand that a certain portion at the beginning of the movie is going to establish who these characters are and what the setting is. But if you're like into an hour of the movie and they're still establishing what the setting is and what the routine is before they throw in what the actual real story is going to be, then you'd probably be, huh, it's kind of boring.
Yeah, true. I don't...
You know, you ever heard of the Gary Shandling Show?
No.
Okay. Anyway, it was a sitcom dropped the fourth wall a lot. And I remember one episode started and he goes, oh, it's too bad you came now because there's nothing interesting is going to happen. You know, I mean, yesterday and this interesting thing happened and last week, blah, blah, blah. But right now, nothing. Yeah, no, it's bad timing. And it, you know, breaking the fourth wall, it's like, yeah, whenever you jump into, even if it's a sitcom, it's that interesting point in their life. You're not watching the routine. And you know, I think that's in a game people expect. It's like, yeah, we're going to break the routine.
Yeah, I certainly don't disagree. And I mentioned I didn't really kind of expect to keep comparing it to Monster Heart so much. But for both games, after the first session, kind of after you've asked these questions and found out a little bit about the characters and found out entering questions to ask about the characters later, that's when the MC is kind of supposed to craft a little bit of what's going to threaten or what's going to happen.
But you can do that in the character creation system or character creation part.
You can.
It's almost like you're talking about what the routine is up until, bam, what's going to happen in the first session is when everything's going to get changed a bit or things are going to threaten the routine. I don't think you need to, after you've sat there and talked out your backstory and everything for what works out to be the equivalent of a session that you then need to spend another session playing out this baseline or, you know, acting out the baseline.
Yeah, but, you know, I think, Wayne, actually, you were following the letter of the game quite well. I was really surprised. I took a look at the main book, and for such a simple rule, you know, five stats and one kind of dice mechanic, the rule book is huge. It's like 300 pages long. And the thing is that it goes through very, very step by step. In the first session, this is a list of what you should do. And after that's done, you should do your homework and do this. And I think you were following that to the letter, Wayne, but I'm not sure how effective it was. I think some of the things that Lyle's talking about how, you know, you don't have to do these things. You can go with the flow. And it seems like in the character of the game, but the book specifically says that, no, this is what you should do in the first session.
Yeah, and, you know, I do agree with what Lyle is saying. And maybe that would be some advice for like future MCs is come up with a couple ideas, just sort of maybe generic threats or generic problems that you can throw at the player characters in that first session. Because it's hard to come up with stuff right on the fly. And like Apocalypse World, it's not a game like D&D where you're going to stat out NPCs and bad guys. Like NPC and MC characters are very much fictional constructs, right? You only have to define them in the fiction. They almost don't even have any numbers attached to them. So it is kind of easy to drop in threats and problems that the PCs have to face. But it's hard to come up with stuff at the drop of a hat. So when the players kind of, you know, come up with something, my advice would be like have a list of something that you can, like a threat you can throw at them right there in the first session to keep things interesting.
And thankfully, the that history section that you go through where the characters are playing on each other for a while, and the MC can kind of sit back and use that time to think of what to do and make it based on the characters' decisions right then and there.
I didn't find that happened all that much.
Well, I think because it had no setting.
Mm.
So everybody's like, oh, what kind of apocalypse world is this?
Mm.
And, yeah, I mean, that's a problem. I think the game tries to have it both ways. Like, here's a blank canvas, or here's your sandbox, feel free to do whatever in it. Oh, and here's a 30-point list of the things that you must do. And there's not a lot of exciting things on that 30-point list.
I think that's a great way of putting it, Lyle. I think it tries to go both ways for it, and the game loses a little bit because of that. I don't want to sound negative, though, because the concept of the game is really, really cool. But I don't think that the execution on the MC side of it is as smooth as it could have been.
I'm going to say that Monster Hearts, although we've just started playing it, is going a lot better, and that we have a much clearer idea of what the setting is, and that we do have that experience of what went wrong with Apocalypse World, is trying to, what we did in the character creation is we tried to kind of bring the game up to the point where there's going to be conflict, and the conflict's going to work. Or at least interest in that we have my character, who's a ghoul, a fairly new ghoul. Yujiro's character is a fairly new ghost. Most depressing story ever. And Chris, you're kind of like the Buffy character. And we're like old friends, but you don't know that we've become these monsters.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to come back to the high school after attending boarding school or monster hunter training camp.
Or something. We don't know why she left.
Yeah.
And then it's going to be like, yeah, we're going to reunite, and that's how it's going to start. But, you know, you imagine that in the movie, it's just like, wow, bam, just what's wrong with you guys? It'd be in a movie, if you can imagine that, it's like, it kind of seems like everything's normal, except for, oh, hold on, everybody's got a secret, and they don't even know each other's secrets.
Right? They're friends, but one's a monster, one's a monster hunter. Oh, my God.
Yeah,
I definitely did learn kind of from the mistakes of Apocalypse World. Mm-hmm. And like you said it before, I think part of this is because Monster Hearts is a much more narrowly focused game. Whereas you said, you say apocalypse, that's pretty much the same as saying fantasy or sci-fi or pulp. It can mean so many things where people just can be coming at it from different angles. So as you said, maybe everybody saying what movie they're envisioning, so just kind of everybody can get on the same page, would help that.
And then we're also recommending to each other. It's like, okay, everybody, we all got to watch Mean Girls before it starts. So we, you know, kind of have some things to go from.
Yeah.
Everybody watch Jennifer's Body. Yeah.
Great movie. Yeah.
What did you guys think about the presentation?
Overall, I think I'm a fan of the game. So, and I'm taking Chris's place in this episode. I really liked the presentation of the book. Mm-hmm. It's just single color, black and white, and it kind of has a sort of punk aesthetic, do it yourself kind of look to it, which I really like.
Yeah, the layout was nice. It felt a lot like a World of Darkness kind of book, in that it seemed like it was trying to be edgy and raw, like it had nudity in it and lots of swear words. I don't know really how effective that was, but I think it was maybe trying to get you into like this dirty, gritty feeling of the game. But it was all right.
I thought the art was fine, and the layout, it's pretty. I think it was kind of a pretty standard layout. Columns with some art. Yeah.
Words.
Words. Mostly English. What Chris said about the swear words, I think that really did turn me off of the game.
Really?
I think it was excessive. It was hard to find a section of the book that there wasn't a lot of profanity. Yeah, I remember like during the revised edition of the World of Darkness books, for whatever reason, they just started putting... I mean, they're always trying to be like, this is an adult game, but then it just seemed to be like the F word this and the F word that. And it actually comes across as a little bit juvenile, even though they're trying to, you know, we're raw and, you know, this is serious, but it doesn't come across that way. And I think It's the same thing here, and actually had the reverse effect. It came across as a little bit juvenile, and it wasn't transporting me into this raw, dirty, gritty, horrific world. It was just kind of sounded like somebody in high school had written a role-playing game. And I, of course, I'm not going to say any of the swear words here, but one of his tips for establishing the setting is Barth Fourth Apocalyptica. And I'm like, I kind of get what you're saying. And maybe if that had been
Vomit Fourth Apocalyptica?
No, I'm not even saying I was really turned off by the
Spew. Blow chunks Fourth Apocalyptica.
Yeah. All right.
Chunks of Apocalyptica.
Okay, I'll just wait you guys out. You guys done? Because there's only so many slang words for Barf. But I think because I'd been like inundated with like swear word after swear word, that by the time I got to that, I was just like, give me a break. Like, just, you know, get a thesaurus. And, you know, I really shouldn't be the guy to say this. but, you know, try to just think of other adjectives that maybe aren't swear words. You know, I know the F word and is pretty versatile. I just don't need to see you use it all the time.
I'm not going to disagree, but I don't know. Like, reading the book, I don't want listeners to think that every other word is the F word.
It's a lot. It's more than any other role-playing game I've ever read.
You're more likely to see it on a page than not.
And I'm not just saying it's only the F word. I mean, I'll say the person was somewhat creative and they used other stuff, but it was more profanity than I would care for.
Okay.
And I found some of the descriptions, and here's this is a balance, and this is not really a criticism. It's a really tough balance to strike, and it's. I guess some people call it flavor text, some people call it fluff, but it's when you kind of kick off your characters, and like Wayne said, they're all like in a little booklet, they get their own space, and sometimes you have like in-character kind of text or in-world text, and they made use of that, and sometimes it was pretty easy to get what this character was, and it kind of helps you. World of Darkness does a pretty good job of striking a balance where it transports you into the world, but also kind of just explain what this character is. But sometimes you really just didn't understand what the character was. You're just like, okay, well, because it would have like an ambiguous name, and then it would have this text of somebody talking in that world, either about that character or they were that character, and you're like, okay, but what is this character?
Yeah. There's one character, the Chopper. And I didn't know what that one meant. It said that, like, this world is all scarcity and there's not enough food or clean water. It's a tough world, but at least there's plenty of bullets and gasoline. And that's where you come in. You're the Chopper. And I didn't get it until after I read like the MC section to say, oh, Chopper is a biker. He's a biker gang guy. All right.
I thought that one was kind of one of the easier ones.
Like afterwards, it's like Chopper. Oh, motorcycle. I get it. But
yeah. But like, I mean, the Hocus was a bit, you know, like, because it's not saying cult leader,
right?
It's saying Hocus, and you're like, oh, okay. And then somebody talking about them and about the miasma and everything, and what are you talking about?
Yeah, the Skinner as well is it's kind of you are something or you take care of things that are beautiful, and I think they're going for ambiguity so that you can choose what that means for your character and for the world, but sometimes that just kind of leaves it with, I don't know, just not enough to really go on for what this class is.
Yeah, that is a difficulty, because the world, there's no setting essentially other than post-apocalyptic, and it's your job to find out what that means. Yeah, I guess you can't really, or the author didn't really want to nail down specific things. And so you do kind of have to be ambiguous in some of the descriptions on the books. I think maybe this is my mistake. In the actual book, they have a section, a couple pages, that introduces the playbook, so the classes, in much more plain English. That kind of says, this is what the character is, kind of this is what they're about. This is what you can kind of expect to do with this character in the game. And rather than, handing out playbooks, perhaps what I just should have done is hand you those few pages and said, these are essentially the classes, what looks interesting.
I don't think you're to blame for that, Wayne. I think that it would be better to put that text right there on the sheet, because it's just a very straightforward explanation of what this character is, what's good about it, you know, what kind of play style it suits. There's no reason that you should get that separate from the characters. Having it right there in addition to the classes would have just been nice.
That, I mean, there is that criticism. Some people say that maybe 4E went too far the other way, saying is like, hey, here are the best stats to take. Here's your role. Yeah, but sometimes, you know, players sometimes need to grab onto that. And I probably wouldn't recommend Apocalypse World for a new player, because they'd be sitting there going, what is this game? What is role playing? And you're like, hey, just do something. And you're like, what am I supposed to do?
Yeah, I've kind of wondered about that. There's a little bit of a tangent, but we've talked about like Fate before and how Fate is very different from other role playing games. And would a new role player be able to grasp that quickly because they have no preconceived notions, or they haven't been sort of trained as to what a role-playing game is? Or would they find it really difficult because there aren't those kind of guidelines for them to follow? And I see Apocalypse World as being very much similar to Fate in that aspect, where, as we said, it's kind of a narrative game, so some players or new players might, you know, kind of take to that like a fish to water if they're an actor, and they can kind of put themselves in a character, and the mechanics will be taught secondary. But other people might say, I don't know what to do because you haven't told me what I can do. So.
Yeah, no, you put that very well.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I've heard other people, and I've heard the author give interviews where some people really don't like, profanity aside, some people really don't like the way the text is written. They kind of find it very forceful. As Chris said, he kind of, and you said, Lyle, there's kind of this list of, here's this. It's not 30, but here are these 30 things you're supposed to do for running the first session of the game, and here's what you're supposed to do to run this game. And yeah, I can understand how some people don't like that, because it's kind of taking a very authoritative tone on how to run this game. But I personally didn't mind it. It, to me, it came off as someone talking to another person who knows what role-playing is, and so isn't going to go through the necessary introductory text of, this is a shared imaginary space and you're going to play a character kind of thing. I just saw it as kind of cutting out the stuff you already know, and him saying, here's how you run the game, do this, and this.
I don't know, I got a feeling that Vincent Baker is a really, really good game master, or MC in this case, and that he was kind of writing up his process of gaming. This is how I play in my sessions, and it goes well for me. But he wrote it up pretty strictly, and I can see how people might have a bad reaction to that. But the biggest thing, and I'm saying it again, is that just the world is meant to be very free form, but it's kind of contrasting with the very strict rules that he sets up for how to MC that world. So the dissonance just doesn't seem to suit the game very well.
I guess, having read all the book, especially like the MC chapter a lot, yeah, there are, as you said, there are a surprisingly large number of pages for this book that is kind of so narrative, and you can boil
it
down.
It has no setting.
And it has no setting, yeah. As Lyle brought up again. But a lot of it, I think, how to explain it? Like in a game like D&D 4E, right, that has very sort of concrete rules, I get the feeling where you can just, like, the author of a D&D book could just say, refer to page 65, or refer to this section on how to run an encounter. Whereas in Apocalypse World, it's a lot of pages, but a lot of it boils down to sort of essentially teaching the game master how to run a sandbox game. A lot of it is kind of saying, I don't know how to explain it well.
I kind of get where you're going. I mean, it almost sounds, in a sense, that the players are in a sandbox and the game master's on a train and being railroaded until they're ready to get off and join the players in the sandbox.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I just made that up.
Yep.
All right. But not only was it our first time to play, I guess these games are called because Monster Hearts is under the same system, and they're the engine...
Oh, Powered by the Apocalypse.
Powered by the Apocalypse. So it's not only our first time playing a Powered by the Apocalypse game, it's also our first time playing a Skype game.
Yeah, and because of the narrative nature of these kind of games, I thought it would be a good game to run over Skype, as opposed to like something that had a grid like 4E, since we were only going to do voice. And overall, I think it worked out pretty well. There was a little bit of confusion certain times with, you know, when we were talking to certain people, if we didn't say their name first. But other than that, I think it went pretty smoothly.
I think some cautions are, is that there's a real danger with Skype that the players will check out. I know, you hear about other gaming groups when people come at the table and they bring their tablets and their laptops. Why? I wouldn't know. But I guess even like smartphones now, it's all those distractions. Mm-hmm. And I think it just, Skype amplifies it because you're actually sitting in front of the computer to do it. So, I mean, that's a danger. So you got to be careful. And that's why I think, yeah, a narrative game like Apocalypse World or Monster Hearts would play better in Skype than another game. But if you're doing like a whole session of Baseline, your players might be reading, you know, Wikipedia or Sports Illustrated or Cracked or something while they're supposed to be baselining because, you know, they're not into the game.
Hmm.
And also, I think it really helped to emphasize to me one of the things I really value about the game is just, or role-playing, is, you know, you meet people face-to-face, people that you like face-to-face, and it's an escape. And when you're playing on Skype, you're not really escaping. You're still sitting in your living room with your husband or your wife or whatever, kind of walking around in the background, and maybe they'll be watching TV. You know, you're still there.
Maybe they'll tell you to be quiet because you're talking too loud.
Yeah, and it's like, oh, the cats are getting to the garbage, yeah. So you do have a lot of distractions, and you can't necessarily immerse yourself as much as face-to-face.
Yeah, I think you saying that reminded me, like, part of the reason why I like role-playing in general is the face-to-face contact.
Yeah.
Like, I've told other people who, you know, kind of know a little bit about the hobby, and especially my girlfriend, I've said, no, this kind of is my, like, other people go to parties, other people do, you know, other social things.
Hey, I still go to parties. I still go to parties.
All right. Man, I just sound really lame, don't I?
Other people never have met friends.
Sorry.
No, but like getting together with my friends and having that social contact is kind of how I recharge my social battery.
Right.
Is the way I see it. Like, I like role playing games, but and I think we said this before in a different episode. I forget what it was. Guys kind of need something to do when they get together.
Yeah.
They kind of can't sit around and talk about their feelings. You know, they don't do that. But
we don't have feelings.
Exactly. Like a machine. But I did feel like something was kind of missing. I just said, well, I was just kind of sitting in front of my computer. Yeah, I was talking to you guys, but it didn't really feel the same.
And when other people were playing, like, they're off doing a separate thing, I wasn't as interested in following that conversation. And again, you're sitting looking at a computer screen, so you go and look at what's online.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you come back to, and you're like, oh, what? My turn? Yeah.
Oh, back to me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there is a danger, but it certainly is convenient if you've got a busy work schedule and it's tough to do it, is like come home from work and then, you know, then arrange to sit in front, you know, sit down for an hour or so. And it certainly helped us have more frequent gaming sessions.
Hmm.
So that was good.
I think it's worth noting as well that we played only with audio. We didn't do a video cast, so that we actually lost quite a bit of the face-to-face interaction that might have otherwise been there. Because I noticed there was actually a lot less laughing during this than usual. I think just because it had to do with people not being there to see their other people's expressions when someone said or did something dumb.
It also could have been we're playing Apocalypse World.
I was thinking that too.
Because when we started Monster Hearts, there was a lot more laughing.
Until Yujiro came up with his backstory, then you're like, oh man.
That was but then we started making fun of the father raping him.
Oh jeez.
And then there are the 80s songs. Ah, the 80s songs.
80s songs, yeah. Yeah, we figure Monster Heart is just one big collection of 80s songs. That's how they wrote the rule book. So what is some advice to make Skype more successful or at least a success? We touched on one a little bit, and that was just because you got the headphones on, you may need to physically separate yourself from other people in the house. So if you've got like the computer room, close the door.
Yeah.
Just to help immerse yourself even more. Yeah, and try not to get too distracted by the other stuff online. I know it can be tough, but maybe if you can even just challenge yourself that your distractions, when something else is happening, is as in-game as possible. Like, we talked about how, like, mottos and chants can help you, like, get into the spirit of a game. Mm-hmm. But even, like, music, I mean, it's really accessible. You can just, like, have some music that you think is very apocalypse-like or fantasy-like, and, you know.
Yeah, if you're playing D&D, you go and scroll through the wizard's image gallery. Something like that.
Well, I'm sure there's a file sharing program or like a picture sharing program where, you know, who's ever running the game could throw up pictures so that everybody can see it on their screen. Mm-hmm. And that would be a way to maybe not minimize distractions, but at least give other people something to look at. Like, oh, if we usually choose pictures for our characters. So I could see doing that and throwing those up on the screen. Like, here are these two characters, and this is the NPC they're interacting. And now the other person, even if they're not involved in the scene, at least has something to look at.
Yeah, that's really good advice, Wayne.
We'll have to find something to do that.
You can make it your screensaver. You know, you know how you have photos, and it just cycles through the photos? Mm-hmm. People could, like, just set up their, you know, monster hearts.
Yeah, take one of those online whiteboards, and then you can draw along with that, or throw up photos of whatever NPC they're talking to at the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You said this in the Friday Night Lights episode, but at the end of our Monster Heart session, I think you said, Lyle, that I might want to choose some kind of, like, title for the game to refer to rather than just, like, the Monster Hearts game. And
yeah.
I was thinking today, maybe since we were talking so much about music and the joke that it's in, you know, all 80s songs, I was thinking maybe actually even choosing a song that you would play a clip of at the beginning of the session, kind of like the intro music to a weekly TV show.
Soundtrack's pretty important to those type of TV shows and movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, Gossip Girl without the music, or The OC
without Glee.
What?
Glee.
We're not doing
Glee without the music.
Yeah. Hey, it's better.
Or it's worse, because now I'm just letting them talk.
So, very quick, thumbs up or thumbs down for Apocalypse World, and then we'll do thumbs up, thumbs down for playing on Skype.
It's going to be thumbs up for both, for me. With the caveat, I think Apocalypse World is a game you have to play in before you can run well.
Okay.
I'll give a tentative thumbs up to Apocalypse World. I don't think it panned out that well for us, but I see a lot of potential in the game and the system. It looks really cool. And for Skype, yeah, very much thumbs up. I'm all digital. I like it.
All right. I'm going to give Apocalypse World a big thumbs down. I don't think it offered very much. I'm not a big fan of this system, to be honest. I'm playing Monster Hearts now, and not because of the system, just because of the setting. I think 300 pages is really excessive for what it offers. And even if you want to be, you want to cover all bases for the setting, at least give them ideas on how to do different settings. I would say, pleasantly surprised with Skype, much better than I expected. There are some huge dangers, but I think you just got to be slightly more disciplined when you're there, because the distractions are really prominent.
No clicking on porn sites.
Yeah. People wandering around behind me. Yeah, that's what I was doing.
Thanks for that, Wayne.
I forgot. Since I live by myself, that's not a problem.
Yeah, that's true.
I really don't want to know that when we're gaming.
And your girlfriend lives in Canada. You met her at summer camp.
The invisible Canadian girlfriend?
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online, www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website. You can listen to it through DriveThruRPG, iTunes, or Stitcher. Post a comment up on the website or on Facebook, or join our forums and talk to us there, or follow us on Twitter. We'd love to hear from you and give more information to you, at least in the case of Twitter. And, see you next time.
How cool was that, my response? One of my girlfriends was.
This is on mic? Because we haven't said bye yet.
You can learn a thing from me. A thing or two from me.
Yeah. Or three.
Yeah. Bye.
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 Drive Through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive Through RPG. The one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.